Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. So we're back with Ann Buclay and David Montgomery, a husband and wife team of scientists and writers. Ann and David's recent book is titled, What Your Food Ate, How to Heal Our Land and Reclaim Our Health. The first part of our conversation, we talked a lot about soil health. We also talked about what our diet has eaten. Another piece of the book, there's quite a discussion about fatty acids and including the omega-3, omega-6 question. I'm wondering if you can summarize that situation. I knew omega-3s were good and I eat lots of salmon, but I didn't appreciate the complexity and how much our food has changed with the balance of omega-3s and omega-6s. So
fats in the human diet are one of the most misunderstood, underestimated, complex areas of the human diet. And for David and I, in researching this book, that is all of that comes through when you start looking into this question of omega-3 fats and omega-6 fats. And so just for those particular names, just relate to where along this particular omega-3 molecule or omega-6 molecule, you find a certain kind of chemical bond. That's the main difference between these fats. But the amazing thing about chemistry is you change one little thing, like the location of a double bond, and you get hugely different functionality out of these fats. So that's basically what's happening here with omega-3 and omega-6 fats. And so how do these get into the human diet? Nan, you had mentioned fish, salmon in particular. Cold water fish are a good source and they have a lot of omega-3s in them. And that relates to salmon biology and where they live and what they do. But unknown to a lot of people is that the landlubber cousins, so to speak, and I guess I wouldn't really say of salmon, but you think of a marine mammal like a sea cow, let's say, or a vegetarian type whale, okay? The landlubber cousins of those marine mammals are what we call ruminants. Mm-hmm. And in agriculture, our domesticated ruminants are the cow, the sheep, and the goat. So we know, of course, that they are herbivores, and the omega-3s, you know, that come into the body, say, of a marine mammal or into the body of a land mammal like a ruminant, all those omega-3s are found in the leafy living parts of plants. So that's a leaf. So picture a ruminant on land out in a pasture grazing around. And as they are pulling in all of these different forages, leaves that are alive are photosynthesizing, and omega-3 fats are key, absolutely key to the process of photosynthesis. So that's where cows, sheep, and goats are getting all the omega-3s that transfer through the plant into their bodies and become incorporated into their meat and into their milk, which then we consume. Now, if you have animals that are not on pasture, that are not eating these alive, these photosynthesizing leaves, the other alternative is they're stuck in a feedlot being fed what people think they ought to be eating, and they want these animals to grow fast and so forth. And so that diet consists of grains. Grains happen to be rich in omega-6 fats. Why? Grains are not a photosynthetic part of the plant. All right. So this is the basic difference in how what animals eat ripples through into their diet. So with respect to the omega-3 to omega-6 fat ratio, that's really what we're talking about when it comes to the type of fat that is in animal foods that get their way into the human diet. Because it turns out both of these fats are important. You don't want to raise omega-3s up on a platform nor do you want to put omega-6 fats, you know, down in a ditch and say we should never, ever eat them. What we're really talking about, and there's far more information on this in the book, is you're looking for a rough balance of these fats. So, you know, you can just think about one omega-3 fat for every omega-6 fat in your diet. And the reason that this is important is has to do with some fairly recent research in the field of immunology. And what we know about the human immune system and its main process, which is inflammation, which we all know a lot more about, probably thanks to COVID. Inflammation it's very useful and it's very necessary, but it's kind of a touchy process, and you really don't want to have it going overboard, and you don't want to tip it into overactivity. It's a little bit like, I always sort of liken it to the process of remodeling a house or taking on a big construction project. You want that remodeling to happen correctly. You want it to happen on time and not go on and on and on. And so in our bodies, when inflammation goes on and on, it just wreaks havoc. But say the COVID-19 virus did get into us, or let's say you've got some abnormal cell growth, you know, not cancerous yet, but it's on its way that direction. Inflammation is what is going to take care of both of those problems. And it's omega-6 fats that turn out to be sort of the initiator, the, you know, push the button. That's what the omega-6 fats can do with respect to inflammation. So you get that process going, you deal with the problem, solve the problem, and then inflammation needs to end. It needs to be resolved. So it's not so much as we often hear about inflammation as pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. It's really better to think about it as normal inflammation, where we want it to start and then we want it to resolve. And what resolves inflammation is omega-3 fats. So our immune cells are in constant communication and interaction. And so those cells that have swept in and started the inflammatory process, as that begins to be solved, things are looking better. That end of the inflammatory process communicates, and the immune cells that then are going to resolve it, they start to grab omega-3 fats out of our cell membranes and from other places, and they build these other molecules that then get into our bloodstream, reach the site of inflammation. And you can sort of picture it as, oh, I'm not sure I have a good metaphor for it, but they're just sort of pulling everybody aside and saying, okay, it's time to leave here. It's time to get back to normal. And because that's where the body wants to be.
So I'm seeing for a healthy inflammatory response, just the need for some kind of balancing between the two kinds of fat in, I guess, probably in timing and in amounts.
Yeah, and that's where the balance comes in. And the other thing about these two fats is they're considered, I've got air quotes here, essential fats. And when you see that word essential in the context of fats or amino acids, what that means is that the only place those come from is foods in the human diet. So our body
we can't make them.
We cannot make them. So that's why, you know, that's an example of why diet is so influential on health in the case of essential fats and essential amino acids. And we've just swamped the omega-3s in the human diet with omega-6s. That's because we're enriching animal foods with omega-6s because so many ruminants are living out their lives in a feedlot on an omega-6-rich diet. And that ripples right through to us. Other big source for omega-6s in our diet is vegetable seed oils. There's a few exceptions to that. Olive oil is not super rich in omega-6s, nor is canola oil. But you take any other kind of vegetable oil in the human diet, you know, peanut oil, safflower oil, that kind of thing. And those oils are quite abundant in omega-6 fats. And those kind of oils are used a lot, almost exclusively, in ultra processed foods. So, you know, you go to the freezer aisle or the middle aisles of the grocery store, just pick up a box of crackers, you know, some TV dinner type thing, look on the back and look at the kind of oil that is in those products. And the ratio on, say, safflower oil or peanut oil. I don't know exactly what it is, but, you know, there's little to no omega-3s in those oils. And like I said, an abundance of omega-6s. So that's the other big source of omega-6s in the human diet. And it's among the many reasons for avoiding and minimizing ultra-processed foods in one's diet. It's just flooding our bodies with unhelpful fats. It's not about being fat. You know, I want to emphasize that. It's about what these fats do in our body. And so with insufficient levels of omega-3, inflammation is running a background rate that a person may not even be aware of, because, you know, you don't necessarily know all the time when inflammation is happening in your body, but it can be running at a low background rate, which, okay, maybe for a day or two, that's no big deal. A week or two, that's no big deal. Years and decades, this takes a toll, especially as we age, on our bodies and how cells and tissues are functioning.
I know it is so easy in our modern world. There are so many subjects that can drive us to cynicism, to despair, to lack of hope, to places where we are not doing ourselves any good and we're not doing the world we live in any good. So let's turn that around and talk about how what we know about soil science and what we know about diet and what we know about agriculture practices, what have we learned in terms of, first let's do farming practices, that could leave the earth a better place for future generations?
When we look back at the history of how people have treated the land over the course and sweep and fate of civilizations, it's kind of an ugly story. It's pretty easy to get depressed about that. We've eroded and degraded a lot of land around the world. By many estimates, roughly about a third of the world's agricultural land has been seriously degraded already, and we're on track, according to the UN, to degrade another third of the world's agricultural production capacity this century, even as our population rises by
that
another third.
That is astounding.
So we're kind of at a crossroads for humanity that if you only look backwards, it can be pretty depressing. But there's farmers around the world who have been working out practices that can actually rejuvenate the soil, rebuild soil fertility, and do it frighteningly fast from a geological perspective, and in ways that make economic sense today. And so if we look forward in terms of how we might adopt these more regenerative soil practices, soil managing practices in farming, we actually have the potential to solve the soil problem in the next few decades, should we really put our collective minds to it. And certainly by the end of the century, even if we do a halfway measures, we've got the knowledge now, we have the technology, we've got ways to think about how to actually solve the soil problem. And there's really good examples we can point to, as Anne and I have in our books, of people who are doing that. So what are the principles and practices through which we could actually do that? Well, a lot of it boils down to building soil health. The thing that we were talking about in our last conversation, there's a lot of advantages to doing it that we could go into, but the key factors for actually doing it are kind of remarkably simple at sort of the 30,000 foot level that you might expect mm-hmm. a geologist to think about these things on. And that is, if we look at the care and feeding of the beneficial life forms in the soil, of the microbial life that Anne was talking about last time, it turns out that if we think about them as an ecological system and how we might foster their productivity, the answers come into fairly clear focus in terms of minimizing disturbance of the soil.
So that's physical disturbance.
Well, both physical disturbance and chemical disturbance. Because if you add a whole lot of nitrogen fertilizer to the soil, you're changing the soil biology in a pretty serious way. You're not necessarily sterilizing it or reducing the number of bacteria, but you're changing who's there. You're changing their community interactions and the composition. You know, sort of like turning all the wildlife in Seattle just into rabbits, something we don't really want to support. And so you think about minimizing the physical and chemical disturbance of the soil. So you're giving them habitat that's undisturbed in terms of keeping the ground covered with living plants, which agriculturally translates into cover crops in between cash crops. So don't leave the ground bare and naked so that it can be eroded, but keep it covered with living plants to build organic matter in the soil, and growing a diversity of plants, either in your cash crops or in your cover crops as part of crop rotations. And those three things, minimal disturbance, cover crops, and diverse crop rotations, translate into cultivating the beneficial life in the soil, and that translates into building soil organic matter and building fertility.
I want to visualize what that might look like. So I'm visualizing a farm field that's not been plowed, that is planted in some kind of crop, and that changes over time, and that in between the rows of whatever your crop is, you've got something else growing. So you're not seeing the bare ground that you sort of normally expect to see.
Yeah, trying to keep as much of the ground covered at all times as you can, which generally means planting through the remains of the last crop, which means you have some, you need some means to like knock it down or kill it off so that you can actually plant new crop through it. But that the old organic matter from that last crop then serves as mulch. You're essentially mulching the old crop in place.
Okay, that's a great way to visualize that. Okay.
You're covering it up, and you can get the diversity in by either growing cover crops in between the rows of row crops, if one is growing row crops, or you can get them in sort of in different seasons when you're not growing, what might used to have been a fallow season or a bare season. You know, plant clover or plant ryegrass or something in between. So there's always some kind of living plant growing that is producing those exudates that Anne talked about. Those compounds plants leak into the soil to feed the life in the soil. Living plants are what does that. And they're growing a diversity of crops that can either be in a diversity of cash crops or it could be a diversity within one's cover crops. The biggest change really is the lack of plowing. And that turns to be a real key to helping to build fertile soils over the long run. You can get away with a little plowing if you have sources of organic matter. Say you have a dairy next door that you have access to the cattle manure, or you have horse manure that can come in as a source of fertilizer and organic matter. Then even if you're plowing and it's degrading organic matter a bit, you can rebuild that with those imports. But the most efficient way to do it is to grow it on site as a cover crop in terms of organic matter and keep the land covered. So that's essentially the simplistic recipe for rebuilding soil fertility. There's farmers who are reintegrating animal husbandry into their operations to allow sheep, cattle, or goats to consume the stubble from the last crop, turn it into manure that then gets returned to the fields, and that's essentially accelerating the breakdown of that organic matter and returning it to the soil in a manner that can help support life in the soil. So you can think of those animals serving as accelerants for rebuilding healthy soil. We all too often think of animals, cows in particular, as agents of land degradation, and where they're overgrazed, that's absolutely true. But they can also be used as agents of soil restoration. It all depends on how they're ranched, how they're farmed, how they're being used, and how they interface with whatever else is growing on the land.
So you talked about, in terms of time, you can regenerate soil and soil ecological communities in, I don't know exactly what you said, but essentially lightning fast in terms of geological time. You know, I think about soil formation, like that's a long geological period in which that happens. So talk to me a little more about the time needed to do this.
Yeah, well, that's a great question because, you know, we all know that if you take a piece of granite and stick it out on the sidewalk, your great-grandchildren could probably come back and see it's still a rock and it wouldn't have turned into soil for a long time. And so when we think about building soil from scratch, turning rocks into fertile soil, it does take a very long time. And the USDA estimates that it would take 500 to 1,000 years to make an inch of fertile soil from scratch. You know, that's a long time. At the rate that we're eroding farms globally, where we're losing about a millimeter and a half of soil off the average field per year, that means you lose that inch of soil that it takes nature 500 years to 1,000 years to build. You could lose it in 2 decades. That's the real problem with soil erosion, the imbalance there. Because if you're losing something faster than you're replacing it, you're running out of it. But if you already have the mineral matter, So say you have a degraded farm where you have soil, but it's been robbed of the organic matter. It's been robbed of all the life that helps to power the nutrient cycling behind all the stuff we've been talking about. You can add the biology back actually remarkably fast, within just a few seasons, in fact. Anne restored the life in our soil in our North Seattle house where we started looking into a lot of these things because she's a gardener, a plant whisperer, I like to think of her as. Over the course of about 10 years, she turned our garden from less than about 2% organic matter up to pushing 10%, which is about 0.5% a rise a year. That's screamingly fast for geology.
Yeah, and that seems phenomenal. And I'm interested in your observation that you can degrade soil really rapidly, but you can also restore it relatively rapidly.
Yeah, so the trick is if you're starting with the mineral part, if all you need to add is the biology and most of it is microbes, you know, their average lifespan is 20 minutes. So you can raise generations of microbes in a year. So if in a couple years, you've gone through an awful lot of microbes and you can build those populations back up really fast if you focus on cultivating the beneficial biology. Now, if you have a bare bedrock surface, say you're up in northern Sweden where the glaciers scraped all the soil off and you're trying to farm on bedrock, well, yeah, that
different could matter.
That's
yeah.
going to take a while. But if you're like we were in Seattle, where you had there's lots of sand on our lot, for example, and glacial till, we had the mineral parts of what could make for soil. The key was adding the biology back. And so with regenerative farming, that's really the key, is to basically, the key to rebuilding worn out land or degraded farms is to reinvigorate, to reinstill the biology. And that can happen in a few seasons, which is remarkably fast. Farmers that we've interviewed that have done to their farms what Ann did to our yard in terms of restoring its fertility and taking it from, you know, a few, you know, less than a couple percent organic matter up to about as much as their particular environment can actually support. We've encountered many farmers who've done that in, you know, on the order of 5 to 10 years, which is really remarkably fast. And they start seeing positive results from regenerative farming practices within just a couple years in terms of their soil starting to get darker, because you can judge the organic matter content of a soil by its color. Dark soils tend to have a lot more carbon in them, and really rich soils tend to be black soils. Really poor soils tend to be khaki soils that look like California beach sand because there's not much organic matter in it. But the key bottom line there is that these regenerative farming practices can actually heal the land remarkably fast. And there's all these attendant benefits that we can harvest from that, both environmentally, economically, and health-wise.
You know, that makes me feel a lot better. That sort of is the germ of thinking about a more hopeful future. Anne, do you want to add something?
I think anybody who has had any kind of encounter with a farm or with a garden, it's quickly apparent that if you give life half a chance, and in particular, let's say, even life forms that you're not particularly fond of or don't want around, even if you don't hammer on them, they will stick around and they will persist. So let's think about the life forms that we really would like to have around us. And if you give them half a chance, life will flourish. Life is a powerful force. And so what we have done for too long and across too many systems of agriculture is we focused more on killing things than, I think, helping the life forms that we need to have around. We focus less on supporting them. And so as an example, what are some of these life forms? It's not necessarily single things, especially when you're talking about the microbial world. We're talking about communities of different kinds of microbes, bacteria, fungi, even viruses, these things called phages, you know, archaea, which are even older than bacteria. Mm-hmm. So they associate in communities. And one of the grandest microbial communities that we know about is actually in the upper end of the digestive tract of ruminants. And so this is what makes, you know, cows in particular look like these sort of walking beer kegs or walking compost heaps or something like that. They are toting around blank load of life, okay? That is what is going on. And you give ruminant biology, that's the heart of their microbiome. You give the ruminant microbiome half a chance, and it can do a lot. It can imbue health on its host organism. It can turn plants that we can't eat, and in some cases that we don't even want around, into food that can nourish our bodies. And so this is an example of what I mean when I say, you know, you give life half a chance and it will take off. And with respect to sort of the transition, say, from conventional to less harmful forms of agriculture, we can't expect for something that we've been doing for decades and centuries to reverse itself overnight. You know, mm-hmm. life is grand, but it's not that grand. But as Dave had kind of just explained, it can happen in pretty short order. And if you liken that, let's say you go, you're a person who has empathy for other people, and you find somebody out there on the street and they're strung out on drugs and they're filled with ultra processed food and they're just kind of, you know, on their last legs here, and you scrape them up, get them into a better situation. The drugs leave the body, the ultra processed foods or just lack of nutrients in general, that whole thing gets reversed. And you know what? In a few days, at the end of the week, at the end of 2 weeks, that person is doing better and they are feeling better because you've removed the things that are harming them.
So, and that's where we find a little bit of hope for.
That's true. Yeah. And you can't, nothing cold turkey, right? That's really not a great idea to do that. It's very abrupt. We know that when we pull the things that are impairing and harming and not supporting the beneficial forms of life and the normal natural processes in the soil or in our bodies, life springs back because we've taken away, you know, the ton of bricks or the toxins or the whatever off of life, and it begins to sort itself out. I think there's kind of a magical thing about life and about bodies, whether the soil, the plant, the animal, or the person, and that is that we like this thing called homeostasis. And homeostasis is this suite of processes, physiology, and so forth that are at that sweet spot. We've got enough, blood sugar is right where we want it. Soil moisture, it's right where we want it. Pathogen levels, low, right where we want them. Those are just some glimpses into what comprises homeostasis. And biology and life thrive on homeostasis, and that is the North Star. And it's possible if we pull away all of the perturbations and all of the disturbance and so on, life can take care of itself, but we have to give it room and we have to support it.
That's a great summary. Thank you so much, the two of you.
Sure. Thank you, Nan.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's Nature Now. If you want to hear more Nature Now, do go to KPTZ's podcast website. And if you'd like to read more about what David and Ann have been writing, their most recent book was called What Your Food Ate.
Our ending music today is Merle Haggard singing The Amber Waves of Grain.
If the amber waves of grain should disappear, and there were no wheat or barley anywhere, would we buy our bread and butter from the Toyota man? Would an Idaho spud be stamp made in Japan? The farm just won't get tended if the farmer isn't here, and the amber waves of grain may disappear.